Now, Psalm 32, another new title we come up on, Meshil, which is a word that means giving instruction. So you'll find quite a few psalms that are instructive. Their main purpose is knowledge or passing information. There are 13 of them altogether. 42 is the next one, then 44 and 45. And notice how they run in a parallel or a group. 32, 42, 44, 45, then 52, 53, 54, 55. Four in a row. 52, 53, 54, and 55. Then 74 is one, and then 78 is one, and then 88 and 89. Two together again, and the last one's 142. So you have these instructive psalms in all the different five books except the fourth book of Psalms. Okay, this is the Psalm of David then to give instruction. So you'll find that very word in the text a little bit later. Verse 8, I will instruct you. So that's the very term here where God is instructing, and that's what this psalm is entitled. Happy or blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven. Now this psalm goes along with Psalm 51, but there's one main difference. In Psalm 51, God made David write it when he didn't know what the outcome was going to be. You know, Psalm 51 was a psalm of repentance when he didn't realize how it was going to end up. Well, Psalm 32 was written right after that. Once God had let him know he was forgiven and he wouldn't be required to forfeit his life, then he writes this psalm here, Psalm 32. And yet it isn't with Psalm 51. It's right here among these in the 30s. And of course you'll see why later. Okay, blessed and happy, how happy is he whose transgression is forgiven? That's quoted in the book of Romans. It supposedly does away with the Old Testament. Now that's kind of dumb, you know. Think the book of Romans does away with the Old Testament. It quotes more out of it than any other book in the New Testament. And this is one of the many examples. Now here the word transgression is the word pesha, rebellion, and not just the word normal word for transgress. So, you know, nobody's going to be cut off just missing the mark. Nobody's cut off just for transgressing. But when you get rebellious and lawless by your very nature and corrupt in your very character, then you're about ready to be extinguished, you know, and hopeless. So here's the word that shows how far David had gone in that sin. He'd murdered Uriah, committed adultery with his wife, deceived God, misrepresented God to the people as their king. So now he says, how happy is he whose rebellion, whose anarchy and lawlessness, whose corrupt nature has been forgiven. Now, this word forgiven literally ties in with the meaning of the Day of Atonement. Literally means taken up and carried away. It's borne away. His transgression is borne away by the goat that bore the sin. Now, he also says, in addition to that, your missing of the mark is covered. In other words, by the death of a substitute, it covers your death. But the word cover didn't mean sacrifice, atone for your sin. Never did mean that. It covered it. It showed you a sacrifice later that would cover yours, that take the place of yours. How happy is the man unto whom the Eternal imputes not iniquity? Now here's the word Adam, showing it goes for all of us. All of us are descendants of Adam. So the man is how happy and blessed, the descendant of Adam, unto whom the Eternal imputes not iniquity. And here the very word iniquity is the word for corruption of nature, avon. And in whose spirit there is no guile. So you notice it has to do with the spirit of the law too, and your attitude. It doesn't just have to do with what you did or didn't do. In whose spirit there's no guile. When I kept silent after he'd committed the sin and hoped God would just forgive it and hoped that somehow it would pass and he wouldn't get caught in it, and so he kept silence. He wouldn't confess it. He wouldn't admit it. So right during that first year, you can read about that back in 2 Samuel 12, in the first few verses. But at first, David's reaction after his sin was keep silence. But then his bones waxed old, and then through his roaring all the day long, so he just had anguish that he couldn't hold in. He just had to continually feel the guilt and the sorrow. Through my roaring all the day long, day and night, your hand was heavy upon me. You notice God wasn't about to let David just sin and forget about it and just let it pass lightly. So God's hand was heavy upon David day and night. So much so that David, it was like, you know, you lose your, you don't have any, your cotton in your mouth, and you feel like your joints are, there's no moisture. My moisture is turned into the drought of summer. I just feel dried out. Selah. Just think about that. And then he connects what he said above with what he says later. Now, this is a great example of what the word Selah means. First of all, you've got to stop and reconsider and review and reread and soak up what he said before, and then tie it in with what comes after. I acknowledged my sin unto you. So at first he kept silence. But now he realized that you're not going to get anywhere that way. God knew it anyway. So what did you accomplish by keeping silence? So right away he changed it. He made up his mind that he was going to acknowledge his sin to God and his iniquity. So he admitted both of what he'd done. Both words the same. So now he quit hiding it. He quit ignoring it and keeping silent about it. So he said, I'll just confess my transgressions unto the Eternal. And notice they're plural. Because he coveted and lusted and killed and committed adultery and what all else. Transgressions unto the Eternal. And you forgave the iniquity of my sin. Think about that. Boy, just let that soak in. At first I hid it, but then I finally made myself realize I should just acknowledge it. And then you forgave, and just think about that. And then the word Selah ties verse 5 in with verse 6 then as a connector between the two. For this shall everyone that's godly pray to you in a time when you may be found. Now that's kind of a frightening reality, that you have to cry out to God when he is near and when he can be found, because it may not always be that way. Everyone that's godly then can pray to God when he may be found. Surely in the floods of great waters they'll not come near to him. So no matter how giant the troubles or how flooded you are with the great waters of trials and troubles, and if you cry out to God, then they won't come near you. So now he says to God, you're my hiding place. And of course, here he's been talking about the name of God. God's dual name is in verse 5, and again now in verse 7, and again in verse 8. And verse 5, he calls the Eternal my righteousness. And then verse 7, the Eternal my hiding place. And then in verse 8, the Eternal my guide. So in the Hebrew, those would just be Yahweh connected with the adjective that describes that. You're my hiding, the Eternal my hiding place. You'll preserve me from trouble. You shall compass me about with songs of deliverance. Now there the word means shoutings, not just songs. You'll compass me about with shoutings of deliverance, celebrating deliverance, shouting it. And then he says, Selah, think about that. Now the Eternal answers David and says, I will meshil you, I'll instruct you and teach you in the way which you shall go. I'll guide you with mine eye. So God answers him there. Be not as the horse, the mule. That's really laying it on you there, isn't it, you know? Quit being a jackass, you know? Quit being a hard-headed mule. Quit being like a horse. Don't be as the horse and the mule, which have no understanding. Their mouth has to be held in with a bit and the bridle. Now God said, I'm not going to do you that way. You wouldn't have any free moral agency. I'll guide you with my eye. I'll guide you with my law, the light, the lamp, with my spirit. But I'm not going to put a bridle in you like a mule or a horse whose mouth has to be held in with a bit and a bridle before you can get them to come near and do what you want them to do. And that's what that last line really says in the Hebrew. Many sorrows shall be to the wicked. They're against Rasha, lawless. But he that has confidence in the Eternal, mercy shall compass him about, grace and loving kindness, mercy. So be glad in the Eternal and rejoice, you righteous. And shout for joy, all you that are upright in heart. Now, we've been taught in our world to not be emotional or spontaneous. And my dad mentioned to Mr. Armstrong when he had his fourth son graduate from Ambassador College, he said, I felt like taking my white Texas hat and just throwing it up in the air and yelling, whoopee! And Mr. Armstrong said, why didn't you? Well, everybody that thought some maniac from Texas was there, you know. But notice how many times in the Bible these people were spontaneous and had real emotion and feeling. Shout for joy, all you that are upright in heart. Now, the next psalm is by David as well. It's one that isn't listed as by him, but when you read it, you'll see it's a continuation of the previous 30s. And apparently God didn't have David's name put in there, assuming if we really studied the Bible and really read it diligently, it'd be dead obvious he wrote it like he did these previous ones. So you notice when we read it how exactly it is, just like the others. Rejoice in the Eternal. And you notice the last verse of the previous chapter said, be glad in the Eternal and rejoice. Shout for joy, all you that are upright in heart. And the very next one begins, rejoice in the Eternal, O you righteous, for praise is comely for the upright. Now notice verse 8 in 32, I'll meshil you and teach you in the way which you'll go. I'll guide you with mine eye. Now notice verse 18 of this one. Behold, the eye of the Eternal is upon them that fear him, upon them that hope in his mercy. You know, when you really study the Psalms and really soak them up and try to let them be a part of your heart, then you'll catch David's writing. Praise is comely for the upright. Praise the Eternal with heart. Sing unto him with the psaltery, an instrument of 10 strings. Sing unto him a new song. Now, of course, you know who the man that composed the